5-1. Grammar, a World Problem by Alice A. Bailey. Recorded by Lucis Trust, New York. Copyright 1950 by Lucis Trust. First printing, 1950. This book contains 290 pages. Table of contents. Certain preliminary clarifications. Page 1, side 1. Section 1, The Nature of Glamour. Page 26, side 1. 1. Glamour upon the mental plane, illusion. Page 53, side 2. 2. Glamour upon the astral plane, glamour. Page 69, side 2. 3. Glamour upon etheric levels, Maya. Page 84, side 2. 4. Glamour upon the higher mental planes, the dweller on the threshold. Page 90, side 3. Section 2, The Causes of Glamour. Page 94, side 3. 1. The Racial and Individual Growth of Glamour. Page 94, side 3. 2. The Causes Producing World Glamour. Page 104, side 3. 3. The Contrast Between Higher and Lower Glamours. Page 125, side 3. A. Illusion and Intuition. Page 128, side 3. B. Glamour and Illumination. Page 139, side 4. C. Maya and Inspiration. Page 148, side 4. D. The Dweller on the Threshold and the Angel of the Presence. Page 152, side 4. Section 3. The Ending of Glamour. Page 161, side 4. 1. Outline of the Technique of the Presence. Page 172, side 4. A. The Intuition Dispels Individual Illusion. Page 177, side 4. B. Group Intuition Dispels World Illusion. Page 184, side 5. 2. Outline of the Technique of Light. Page 190, side 5. A. Individual Glamour. Page 202, side 5. B. Group Glamour and World Glamour. Page 221, side 5. 3. Outline of the Technique of Indifference. Page 241, side 6. A. Force Distribution and Manipulation upon the Etheric Plane. Page 246, side 6. B. The Use of the Science of the Breath. Page 253, side 6. C. The Technique of Indifference. Page 260, side 6. Section 4. The Technique of Fusion. Page 266, side 6. Index. Page 275. Delete it. Extract from a statement by the Tibetan. Suffice it to say that I am a Tibetan disciple of a certain degree, and this tells you but little, for all are disciples, from the humblest aspirant up to and beyond the Christ himself. I live in a physical body, like other men, on the borders of Tibet, and at times, from the exoteric standpoint, preside over a large group of Tibetan lamas when my other duties permit. It is this fact that has caused it to be reported that I am an abbot of this particular lamasery. Those associated with me in the work of the hierarchy, and all true disciples are associated in this work, know me by still another name and office. AAB knows who I am and recognizes me by two of my names. I am a brother of yours who has traveled a little longer upon the path than has the average student, and has therefore incurred greater responsibilities. I am one who has wrestled and fought his way into a greater measure of light than has the aspirant who will read this article, and I must therefore act as a transmitter of the light, no matter what the cost. I am not an old man, as age counts among the teachers, yet I am not young or inexperienced. My work is to teach and spread the knowledge of the ageless wisdom wherever I can find a response, and I have been doing this for many years. I seek also to help the Master M and the Master KH whenever opportunity offers, for I have been long connected with them and with their work. In all the above, I have told you much, yet at the same time I have told you nothing which would lead you to offer me that blind obedience and the foolish devotion which the emotional aspirant offers to the Guru and Master whom he is as yet unable to contact. Nor will he make that desired contact until he has transmuted emotional devotion into unselfish service to humanity, not to the Master. The books that I have written are sent out with no claim for their acceptance. They may or may not be correct, true, and useful, It is for you to ascertain their truth by right practice and by the exercise of the intuition. Neither I nor AAB is the least interested in having them acclaimed as inspired writings, or in having anyone speak of them, with bated breath, as being the work of one of the masters. If they present truth in such a way that it follows sequentially upon that already offered in the world teachings, if the information given raises the aspiration and the will to serve from the plane of the emotions to that of the mind, the plane whereon the masters can be found, then they will have served their purpose. If the teaching conveyed calls forth a response from the illumined mind of the worker in the world and brings a flashing forth of his intuition, then let that teaching be accepted, but not otherwise. If the statements meet with eventual corroboration or are deemed true under the test of the law of correspondences, then that is well and good. But should this not be so, let not the student accept what is said. August 1934. The Great Invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Quote, the above invocation or prayer does not belong to any person or group, but to all humanity. The beauty and the strength of this invocation lies in its simplicity and in its expression of certain central truths which all men innately and normally accept. The truth of the existence of a basic intelligence to whom we vaguely give the name of God. The truth that behind all outer seeming, the motivating power of the universe is love. The truth that a great individuality came to earth, called by Christians the Christ, and embodied that love so that we could understand. The truth that both love and intelligence are effects of what is called the will of God. And finally, the self-evident truth that only through humanity itself can the divine plan work out. Close quote. Alice A. Bailey. Publisher's Statement. In Discipleship in the New Age, Volumes 1 and 2, certain personal instructions given by the Tibetan to a group of disciples were made public. These instructions, together with certain esoteric teaching, were first published by Alice A. Bailey, with the consent of the disciples involved, in 1944. Unpublished manuscripts containing additional instructions and esoteric teachings, as completed by Mrs. Bailey, are now available. This text was written from time to time over a period of 9 years, from 1935 to 1944. In various places in the text of Glamour, A World Problem, references are made to the same discipleship group. In the present volume, certain forms of group work and meditation are included because of their informative value and because they illustrate the practical value of the teaching given. The reader, however, should recognize that meditations suitable for special group purposes are not, in general, as effective when used as an individual exercise. The potency of an integrated group composed of disciples who have a common vision and an established group purpose is very great and can be a real service to mankind. The newer Aquarian techniques include such group endeavors. The published writings by the Tibetan and Alice A. Bailey provide information for wise and useful experimentation in group work, which is undertaken as a spiritual world service and not as a means of spiritual unfoldment of the individual aspirant. Such group action, voluntarily entered into when not dominated by autocratic leadership control, and if undertaken with due humility and caution, is greatly to be desired at the present time. such action should be recognized as being pioneering experimental ventures. Groups of this sort have already appeared in various parts of the world and may well contribute to the success of the work of the new group of world servers. Information about this worldwide group of servers is given in A Treatise on White Magic and in A Treatise on the Seven Rays, Volume 2. Foster Bailey, July 1950. Certain preliminary clarifications. All groups involved in esoteric work have their own dharma or duty, and all have their peculiar objective. In order that you may clearly vision what you as aspirants to discipleship have to do, and so intelligently cooperate, I will concisely state the purpose. Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, means duty or obligation, and it is your definite and specific obligation to develop the intuition. The means or methods whereby this development is to be brought about can be by the study of symbols. I would ask you to note that generalities concerning the intuition and attempts to define it are very common, but that a real appreciation of it is rare. We are told by physicians and scientists that thousands of cells in the human brain are still dormant, and consequently that the average human being uses only a small part of his equipment. The area of the brain which is found around the pineal gland is that connected with the intuition, and it is these cells which must be roused into activity before there can be any real intuitive perception which, when aroused, will manifest soul control, spiritual illumination, true psychological understanding of one's fellow men, and a development of the true esoteric sense, which is the objective before you at this time. I would like to divide what I have to say into three parts, and I plead for a close study of my words. Roman numeral 1, I seek to define for you the intuition. Roman numeral 2, I shall deal with its mode of development through the study of symbology. Roman numeral 3, I shall close by giving some specific instructions as to a useful mode of procedure. Should you therefore find these articles hard to understand and your reaction slow, you must bear in mind that this indicates your need for this study and corroborates what I am telling you. If you will seriously consider with me what the intuition is not, I think my words will find in you an inner response. Roman numeral 1, definition of the intuition. The intuition is not a welling forth of love to people and therefore an understanding of them. Much that is called the intuition is recognition of similarities and the possession of a clear analytical mind. Intelligent people who have lived in the world for some time and who have experienced much and who have contacted many other people can usually sum up with facility the problems and dispositions of others, provided they are interested. This they must not, however, confound with the intuition. The intuition has no relation to psychism, either higher or lower. The seeing of a vision, the hearing of the voice of the silence, a pleased reaction to teaching of any kind, does not infer the functioning of the intuition. It is not only the seeing of symbols, for that is a special sort of perception, and the capacity to tune in on the universal mind, upon that layer of its activity which produces the pattern forms on which all etheric bodies are based. It is not intelligent psychology and a loving desire to help. That emanates from the interplay of a personality, governed by a strong soul orientation and the group conscious soul. Intuition is the synthetic understanding which is the prerogative of the soul, and it only becomes possible when the soul, on its own level, is reaching in two directions, towards the monad and towards the integrated and perhaps even, if only temporarily, coordinated and at one personality. It is the first indication of a deeply subjective unification which will find its consummation at the third initiation. Intuition is a comprehensive grip of the principle of universality, and when it is functioning, there is, momentarily at least, a complete loss of the sense of separateness. At its highest point, it is known as that universal love which has no relation to sentiment or to the affectional reaction, but is predominantly in the nature of an identification with all beings. Then is true compassion known. Then does criticism become impossible. Then only is the divine germ seen as latent in all forms. Intuition is light itself, and when it is functioning, the world is seen as light, and the light bodies of all forms become gradually apparent. This brings with it the ability to contact the light center in all forms, and thus again an essential relationship is established, and the sense of superiority and separateness recedes into the background. Intuition, therefore, brings with its appearance three qualities. Illumination. By illumination, I do not mean the light in the head. That is incidental and phenomenal, and many truly intuitive people are entirely unaware of this light. The light to which I refer is that which irradiates the way. It is the light of the intellect, which really means that which illumines the mind and which can reflect itself in that mental apparatus which is held steady in the light. This is the light of the world, a reality which is eternally existent, but which can be discovered only when the individual interior light is recognized as such. This is the light of the ages, which shineth evermore until the day be with us. The intuition is therefore the recognition in oneself, not theoretically, but as a fact in one's experience, of one's complete identification with the universal mind, of one's constituting a part of the great world life, and of one's participation in the eternal persisting existence. Understanding. This must be appreciated in its literal sense as that which stands under the totality of forms. It connotes the power of recession or the capacity to withdraw from one's age-long identification with form life. I would like to point out that this withdrawal is comparatively easy for those who have much of the first ray quality in them. The problem is to withdraw in the esoteric sense, but to avoid at the same time the sense of separateness, of isolation, and of superiority. It is easy for first ray people to resist the tendency to identify themselves with others. To have true understanding involves an increased ability to love all beings, and yet at the same time to preserve personality detachment. This detachment can be so easily founded on an inability to love, in a selfish concern for one's own comfort, physical, mental, or spiritual, and above all, emotional. First-ray people dread emotion and despise it, but sometimes they have to swing into an emotional condition before they can use emotional sensitivity in the right manner. Understanding involves contact with life as an integrated personality, plus egoic reaction to the group purposes and plans. It connotes personality's soul, unification, wide experience, and a rapid activity of the indwelling Christ principle. Intuitional understanding is always spontaneous. Where the reasoning to an understanding enters, it is not the activity of the intuition. Love. As earlier said, this is not affectionate sentiment or the possession of a loving disposition. These two later aspects are incidental and sequential. When the intuition is developed, both affection and the possession of a spirit of loving outgo will necessarily, in their pure form, be demonstrated. But that which produces these is something much more deep and comprehensive. It is that synthetic, inclusive grasp of the life and needs of all beings, I have chosen these two words with intent, which it is the high prerogative of a divine Son of God to operate. It negates all that builds barriers, makes criticism, and produces separation. It sees no distinction even when it appreciates need, and it produces in one who loves as a soul immediate identification with that which is loved. These three words sum up the three qualities or aspects of the intuition and can be covered by the word universality, or the sense of universal oneness. Is that not something which all aspirants aim to achieve? And is it not something that each of you, as individuals, needs in a peculiar sense? Where it is present, there is an immediate decentralization of the dramatic I, of that capacity always to relate all happenings, all phenomena, all group work to oneself as the center. I cannot enlarge further upon the subject of intuition. It is too vast a matter and too abstruse. All I can do is to put before you its three aspects, and then to urge upon you the need to submit to that training and to apply to yourselves that discipline which will work out in your life as love, light, and understanding. When the theory is grasped and the right adjustments are made, and when the needed work is done, the personality then becomes magnetic, whilst the brain cells around the pineal gland, which have hitherto been dormant, become awakened and vibrant. The nucleus of every cell in the body is a point of light, and when the light of the intuition is sensed, it is this cell light which will immediately respond. The continuance of the inflow of the light of the intuition will draw forth, esoterically speaking, into the light of day every cell which is so constituted that it will respond. Roman numeral 2, the mode of awakening the intuition. There are many ways in which the intuition can be drawn into activity, and one of the most useful and potent is the study and interpretation of symbols. Symbols are the outer and visible forms of the inner spiritual realities, and when facility in discovering the reality behind any specific form has been gained, that very fact will indicate the awakening of the intuition. First-ray people belong to what is called the destroyer ray, and the power of the first aspect, which is the power to bring to an end, flows through them. They will have a tendency to destroy as they build, through a wrong direction of energy, through overemphasis of energy in some particular direction, or through misuse of energy in work with themselves or others. Many first-ray people have the tendency to pride themselves on this and hide behind a plea that, being upon the first ray, a destructive tendency is unavoidable. Such is not the case. Builders, such as second-ray people always are, have to learn to destroy when prompted by group love and acting under the will or first ray aspect. Destroyers have to learn to build, acting ever under the impulse of group love and utilizing the power of attachment in a detached manner. Both groups, builders and destroyers, must ever work from the standpoint of reality, from the inner nucleus of truth, and must take their stand at the center. The study of symbols tends to bring this about, and when carried out with faithfulness and diligence, will produce three effects. One, it trains in the power to penetrate behind the form and to arrive at the subjective reality. Two, it tends to bring about a close integration between soul, mind, brain, and when that is brought about, the inflow of the intuition and consequently of illumination and truth becomes more rapidly possible. Three, it will put a strain upon certain unawakened areas in the brain and arouse into activity the brain cells there found, and this is the first stage in the experience of the aspirant. With the majority of true aspirants, the center between the eyebrows is awakened, whilst the center at the top of the head is vibrating very gently, but is not in full functioning activity. This higher center must be awakened more fully before aspirants can measure up to their full opportunity. In the study of symbols, I would urge upon you the necessity always to put before yourselves the goal of arriving at the underlying concept of any symbol studied. This concept will ever be synthetic. It will not be detailed and in sections. You may have to arrive at this concept through a study of detail, and through arriving at the significance of various sections or parts of the symbol under consideration. When, however, your analysis is completed, you must not rest satisfied until you have summed up the meaning of the symbol in some synthetic idea, concept, meaning, or name. Symbols have to be studied in three ways. A. Exoterically. This involves study of its form as a whole, of its lines and therefore of its numerical significance, and also study of its sectional forms, by which I mean its arrangements, for instance, of cubes, triangles, and of stars and their mutual interrelation. B. Conceptually. This involves arriving at its underlying idea, which may be expressed in its name. at its meaning as that emerges in the consciousness through meditation, and at its significance as a whole or in part. You should, when doing this, bear in mind that the idea connotes the higher or abstract intent, that the meaning is that intent expressed in terms of the concrete mind, and that its significance has in it more of an emotional quality and might be expressed as the type of desire it arouses in you. See? Esoterically. This would cover the effect of the force or energy upon you and of the quality of the vibration it may arouse in you, perhaps in some center, perhaps in your astral body, or perhaps only in your mind. This study, rightly undertaken, would lead to the unfoldment of the intuition, with its consequent manifestation on the physical plane as illumination, understanding, and love. In the first instance, the objective of the study of symbolism is to enable the student to sense its quality and to contact that vibrant something which lies behind that aggregate of line, color, and form of which the symbol is composed. To some types of people, this study is relatively easy. To the majority, it is not easy at all, thereby indicating a lack that must be supplied by the use of those faculties at the present dormant. It is always distasteful to arouse the latent faculties and requires an effort and a determination not to be swayed by personality reactions. To many, it is not easily apparent how the penetration into the meaning of a symbol can provide a means whereby the dormant buddhic or intuitional faculty can be brought into functioning activity. It is a delicate art, this art of symbol reading, of spiritual reading, as our ancient master Patanjali calls it. This power to interpret symbols ever precedes true revelation. The comprehension of a truth for which a line or a series of lines composing a symbolic form may stand is not all that has to be done. A good memory may remind you that a series of lines forming a triangle or a series of triangles signifies the Trinity or any series of triplicates within the macrocosmic or microcosmic manifestation. But that activity and accuracy of the memory will do naught to awaken the dormant brain cells or call into play the intuition. It must be remembered, and here becomes evident the value of a certain amount of technical or academic occultism, that the plane whereon the intuition manifests and where the intuitional state of consciousness is active is that of the buddhic or intuitional plane. This plane is the higher correspondence of the astral or emotional plane, the plane of sensitive awareness through a felt identification with the object of attention or attraction. It becomes evident, therefore, that if the intuitional faculty is to be brought into activity through the study of symbols, the student must feel with, or be in some way identified with, the qualitative nature of the symbol with the nature of that reality which the symbolic form veils. It is this aspect of symbolic reading that you are asked to study. Students should ascertain, therefore, after due study of the form aspect, what the symbol is doing to them, what feeling it evokes, what aspirations it arouses, and what dreams, illusions, and reactions are consciously registered. This stage is an intermediate one between the exoteric reading of a symbol and the conceptual understanding. There is later another intermediate stage between conceptual understanding and esoteric comprehension and application. This latter stage is called synthetic recognition. Having studied the form and become aware of its emotional significance, you pass to the stage of grasping the basic idea of the symbol and from thence to a synthetic comprehension of its purpose. This leads to true esotericism, which is the practical application of its living synthetic power to the springs of individual life and action. I would ask you to render not only an intelligent interpretation of the symbol, but also a recognition of the more subtle reaction of your sensitive feeling nature to the symbol as a whole. Study a total of 4 symbols a year. First, approach the symbol from its form aspect and seek to familiarize yourself with its outer aspect, with the sum total of lines, triangles, squares, circles, crosses, and other forms of which it is composed. And as you do this, endeavor to comprehend it from the standpoint of the intellect, using your memory and what knowledge you have to understand it exoterically. Then, as soon as the symbol is truly familiar to you and can be recalled to mind with little effort, endeavor to sense its quality, to contact its vibration, and to note its emotional effect upon you. This may vary from day to day, or it may always be the same. Be simply honest in your noting this astral reaction to the symbol and see where such reactions lead you, remembering always that they are not intuitional, but are reactions to the feeling or astral body. Finally, take note of what you have found to be, for you, the basic quality of the symbol, and then, as in meditation work, lift the whole subject into the mental realm by bringing the focused, attentive mind to bear upon it. This will lead you into the realm of concepts. We have, consequently, the following stages in the analysis of a symbol. 1. Its exoteric consideration, line, form, and color. 2. A comprehension in the astral or emotional body of its quality, the reaction of a sensitive response to the impact of its qualitative nature. 3. A conceptual consideration of its underlying idea, of what it is intended to teach, of the intellectual meaning it is intended to convey. 4. The stage of the synthetic grasp of the purpose of a symbol, of its place in an ordered manifesting plan, of its true unified intent. 5. Identification with the quality and purpose of the symbol as it is illuminated by the mind held steady in the light. This final stage brings into activity the brain as well as the mind. The study of symbols viewed as a whole involves 3 stages. First, the investigation of a symbol and the consequent progress of the analyst from one progressive stage of awareness to another, to a gradual inclusion of the entire field covered by the symbol. Secondly, an intuitive perception of the symbols to be seen everywhere in the divine manifestation. Third, the use of symbols on the physical plane and their right adaptation to a seen and recognized purpose, leading to the subsequent magnetization of the symbol with the needed quality through which the idea can make its presence felt in order that the intuited, qualified idea may find proper form on the physical plane. Deal, therefore, with the symbols in a wide generalization, exoteric, conceptual, and esoteric, but add to that an analysis of your sensitivity and response to the quality of the symbol. Let me recapitulate for a moment. First of all, it is valuable to remember that the study of the symbol exoterically involves the use of the brain and the memory. You endeavor to study line and form, number and general external aspects, knowing that each line has significance, all numbers have their interpretation, and all forms are symbols of an inner quality and life. The study of symbols, conceptually, carries you inward from the brain to the mind into the realm of ideas. It sweeps into focused activity the mental apparatus. You then become aware of the concept or idea which the sign or symbol embodies. You comprehend its meaning and for what it stands. You grasp the purpose for which the form has been brought into manifestation. Your study of number and of line has given you a rich background of knowledge upon the objective plane, a richness in this case dependent upon your own personal reading, mental equipment, and knowledge. Your capacity to read a meaning into a symbol will be dependent also upon the richness of the meaning you ascribe to the events of your daily life and your ability to really meditate. I would like to make clear to you that there is no set interpretation of any symbol, and that for each human being, that symbol, whatever it may be, will convey unique meaning. A lack of interest in symbols presupposes usually a lack of interest in the due interpretation of life forms and their meaning. Also, too much academic interest in symbols may presuppose a tortuous and intricate mind which loves design and line and form and numerical relationships, but which misses entirely the significance of meaning. The balancing in the mind of form and concept, of expression and quality, of sign and meaning, is vital to the growth of the disciple and the aspirant. The great need for most students is to arrive at meaning and to work with ideas and concepts. This activity will necessitate the use of the mind to understand, to grasp and to interpret. It requires the development of that mental sensitivity which will enable its possessor to respond to the vibrations of what we call the universal mind, the mind of God, the instigator of the plan. It presupposes a certain ability to interpret and the power to express the idea underlying the symbol so that others may share it with you. This thought of service and of growth in usefulness must be steadily borne in mind. Can you not see how this power to study, to interpret, and to penetrate to meaning will further your growth spiritually? Can you believe that through the use of this method, you may learn to work more intelligently with the plan and become a better helper of your fellow man? What is there in this objective world that is not the inadequate symbol of a divine idea? What have we in our outer manifestation but the visible sign at some stage of the evolving purpose of the plan of the creating deity? What are you yourself but the outer expression of a divine idea? We must learn to see symbols all around us and then to penetrate behind the symbol to the idea which it should express. There is, however, a technique of study which may be of service to you as you attempt to arrive at an idea and thus study conceptually the many symbols by which we are surrounded. It is largely the technique for which meditation should have prepared you. The difference between this technique and meditation work is mainly one of polarization and goal. In the study of symbols conceptually, the consciousness is polarized in the mental body, and no attempt is definitely made to contact or involve the soul or ego. Herein lies the distinction between this second stage of symbol interpretation and ordinary meditation. You have exhausted the method of familiarizing yourself with the form aspect of the symbol, and you know well its outer contour and externalization. You know, too, that a peculiar series of lines, such as, for instance, the three lines forming a triangle, represent such and such an idea or truth or teaching. This is recorded in your brain, drawing on the resources of your memory. The registering of old information and knowledge anent the figures in a symbol serves to pull your consciousness up onto the mental plane and to focus it there in the world of ideas or of concepts. The concepts exist already upon the concrete levels of the mental plane. They are your mental and racial heritage and are ancient mental forms which you can now employ in order to arrive at meaning and significance. It is an ancient statement of fact which Plutarch expresses for us in the familiar words that, quote, an idea is a being incorporeal which has no subsistence of itself, but gives figure and form unto shapeless matter and becomes the cause of the manifestation, close quote. The figure and form you have registered with your brain and memorized, and likewise its activity in time and space, along with its innate capacity to build the form and express through that form a concept or idea. As you work inwards, you are also becoming aware of the nature of the motivating idea through the study of its form and its demonstrated activity, and you are discovering the field of ideas of analogous nature in which the idea embodied in the symbol finds itself. This field of ideas, interrelated and mutually explanatory, is now open to you, and you will increasingly find yourself in a position to move in this world of concepts with freedom. To work and live in the world of ideas now becomes your objective and main effort. You train yourself in the recognition of ideas and concepts as they lie behind every form. You begin to think clearly about them and to see the direction in which they lead you and where, within the eternal plan, they fit. If aspirants will do three things, A, develop the power to visualize, B, train the mind to intuit reality, C, rightly interpret that which is seen, they can provide a demonstrating laboratory for the trained observers of the world. One of the things which the developed intuition can do is to break the glamour and illusion which invade the life. One of the things that a group of aspirants whose intuitional interplay is established can accomplish is to aid in the work of smashing world glamour. Such work can be done when you have awakened the intuition and when your interrelated understanding is firm and true. the hierarchy will be able to use the world aspirants as an instrument for the breaking of group glamour wherever it may be found. I refer to this possibility in order to incite you all to more rapid and steady growth and effort. You have been told that one of the needs lying before all aspirants is to arrive at that intuitional knowledge and that intelligent understanding of glamour, both individual and planetary, which will enable them most definitely to work at its dispelling. That understanding will necessarily be only relative, but in the course of the next few years, your knowledge of the subject and of the methods whereby glamour can be dissipated can be materially increased. This must happen if you work at the problem consciously in your own lives and attempt to grasp the underlying theory also. Very little has been written or taught hitherto anent the subject of glamour, and it may mean much of value if we undertake the consideration of this subject, of its causes and its effects, and also deal with the technique whereby it can be dissipated and dispelled. It is obvious that I cannot deal with the subject adequately in one instruction, and we will take the next 2 or 3 years, therefore, to discuss and study this important matter, growing out of the need of the present time and the increased sensitivity of humanity to subtler impressions. It has not been possible for me to do this up till now, as the group was incomplete and the inner cohesion needed strengthening. Now I can do so, as the group members are functioning together with a much increased inner relationship, and a spirit of love has been shed abroad among you through the group reaction to each other's need in the recent period of glamour. It is my intention, therefore, to change your work somewhat, retaining the symbolic phrases as an exercise for your intuitional insight, but dropping the consideration of the more formal and visual symbols. You have not gained from these symbolic forms what has been hoped, for the concrete mind of the majority of the group members simply increased the form aspect, and the remainder needed not this method of instruction and development. We shall change the focus of attention to a deep study of glamour. Herein will lie your service, for as you think truly and use your illumined intelligence, if you can achieve this, my brothers, you can help in time to do 2 things. 1. Clarify the group mind on this subject. I refer not here to your particular group, but to the world consciousness. 2. Help shatter the great illusion which has held and still holds the sons of men in thrall. I ask, therefore, for your service along these lines, and I request also that you give increased attention at the time of your full moon contact with myself. This group should have a special aptitude for work along the line of dispelling glamour at the period of the full moon. Contact is made on the different planes according to the focus of the subtle bodies of the personnel of the group, and this group makes its contact with me on the higher levels of the astral plane. Hence the clarity of their reactions and the wealth of their detailed records. Also, herein will lie eventually their service, for they can later, but not for some long time yet, utilize the days of contact and the moment of entrance, as it is sometimes called, for definite work in dispelling some of the world illusion. First must come, however, aptitude in dispelling it in the personal life of each one of you. Another group makes its contact with me on mental levels, and therein will lie their field of service. Still other groups are only as yet in an embryonic stage. Their personnel is incomplete, and the group integration only in process of being set up. I will therefore ask you to intensify your effort each month at the full moon period and seek to strengthen your tie with myself and with your fellow group members. 1 word of warning only will I give. Success along this line will bring both its rewards and also its difficulties. You will have to watch with care for the undue stimulation of your astral or emotional nature with consequent and subsequent glamour. You will have to exercise the deepest watchfulness in the endeavor to work thus on the astral plane, holding simultaneously the attitude of the observer on the high plane of the soul. No constructive work and no service of vital importance can be rendered in this difficult sphere of activity unless there is this detached and liberated attitude. You are to work in one of the most difficult spheres of activity, perhaps the most difficult to which a disciple can be called, and hence the advisability of working there in group formation. I cannot emphasize too strongly that you are to work as a group and not as individuals.
Side 2 of cassette number 1, Glamour, a World Problem. Continuing on page 18.
Three great events are imminent in the world consciousness today. 1. The growth and understanding of telepathic work. 2. A comprehension and scientific investigation of illusion and world glamour. 3. An increase in the right methods of healing. If this is so, you can see how groups of disciples can constitute a contribution to the emerging revelation and how useful our consecrated service can be. I say our advisedly, Brother of Old, as I am working definitely towards these three ends as a part of my ordained, self-ordained service. I ask for your cooperation and assistance. The steady impact of right thought on the human consciousness by trained groups of thinkers is the method that can be most successfully applied at this time, and here these groups can help profoundly. One of the things which will emerge most definitely during the next 3 or 4 decades is the work that groups can do on levels other than the physical. Group service and united effort towards group welfare has for 2 centuries been seen on Earth in all fields of human endeavor, political, philanthropic, and educational. Group service on the astral plane has been started also since 1875, but united effort to dispel the world glamour is only now in process of organizing, and this group can be a part of the corporate effort towards this end and swell the number of those so engaged. Train yourselves, therefore, and learn how to work. Telepathic sensitivity is necessarily the objective of all groups of disciples, but it is the main objective of that group which we might call the telepathic communicators. Here they can render potent service. Groups of sensitives of this order can constitute a working, mediating body and transmit the new knowledge and teaching for the race. They can mold public opinion and change the current of men's thoughts. All small groups of people, naturally and inevitably, arrive at a telepathic relation between themselves and between the personnel of similar groups, and this is to be desired and fostered and should rightly and steadily increase. But as your telepathic sensitivity is increased, see to it that you are not deflected from your main group objective, which is to study and understand the significance of glamour and the laws for its dissipation. Record and note all telepathic activity and phenomena, and learn to work this way, but regard it as a secondary issue for you at this time. One of the outstanding characteristics of the work done at the time of the full moon will be the mass of phenomena noted. This is to be expected, as this service calls you to work on the astral plane, but it will provide you with a feel for the wise use of the faculty of discrimination. It is too early as yet for you to work at the problem of separating the real from the unreal. Your task at first will be recording. Keep detailed records. Preserve the scientific attitude of detachment and of recognition, and write down all that is sensed, seen, or contacted. These records will serve as the basis of analysis if all goes well, and from that analysis we may gather much of value. What I have to say to you as regards the subject of glamour falls into certain broad generalizations, such as 1. The nature of glamour, 2. The causes of glamour, 3. The dissipation of glamour. As we proceed, we shall divide our subject up into greater detail, but in this instruction I only seek to get certain broad outlines into your minds so that the theme may fall into right places in your thoughts. There are 4 phrases which have for long been bandied about among so-called occultists and esotericists. They are glamour, illusion, Maya, and the expression the dweller on the threshold. They all stand for the same general concept or some differentiation of that concept. Speaking generally, the interpretations have been as follows, and they are only partial interpretations and are almost in the nature of distortions of the real truth owing to the limitations of the human consciousness. Glamour has oft been regarded as a curious attempt of what are called the black forces to deceive and hoodwink well-meaning aspirants. Many fine people are almost flattered when they are up against some aspect of glamour, feeling that their demonstration of discipline has been so good that the black forces are interested sufficiently to attempt to hinder their fine work by submerging them in clouds of glamour. Nothing could be further from the truth. That idea is itself part of the glamour of the present time and has its roots in human pride and satisfaction. Maya is oft regarded as being of the same nature as the concept promulgated by the Christian Scientists that there is no such thing as matter. We are asked to regard the entire world phenomena as Maya and to believe that its existence is simply an error of mortal mind and a form of autosuggestion or self-hypnotism. Through this induced belief, we force ourselves into a state of mind which recognizes that the tangible and the objective are only figments of man's imaginative mind. This, in its turn, is likewise a travesty of reality. Illusion is regarded rather the same way, only, as we define it, we lay the emphasis upon the finiteness of man's mind. The world of phenomena is not denied, but we regard the mind as misinterpreting it and as refusing to see it as it is in reality. We consider this misinterpretation as constituting the great illusion. The dweller on the threshold is usually regarded as presenting the final test of man's courage and as being in the nature of a gigantic thought form or factor which has to be dissipated prior to taking initiation. Just what this thought form is, few people know, but their definition includes the idea of a huge elemental form which bars the way to the sacred portal, or the idea of a fabricated form constructed sometimes by the disciple's master to test his sincerity. Some regard it as the sum total of a man's faults, his evil nature, which hinders his being recognized as fit to tread the path of holiness. None of these definitions, however, give a true idea of the reality. I would point out here that, generally speaking, these four expressions are four aspects of a universal condition that is the result of the activity in time and space of the human mind. The activity of minds. Ponder on this phrase, for it gives you a clue to the truth. The problem of illusion lies in the fact that it is a soul activity and the result of the mind aspect of all the souls in manifestation. It is the soul which is submerged in the illusion, and the soul that fails to see with clarity until such time as it has learnt to pour the light of the soul through into the mind and the brain. The problem of glamour is found when the mental illusion is intensified by desire. What the theosophist calls karma manas produces glamour. It is illusion on the astral plane. The problem of Maya is really the same as the above, plus the intense activity produced when both glamour and illusion are realized on etheric levels. It is that vital, unthinking, emotional mess, yes, brother of old, that is the word I seek to use, in which the majority of human beings seem always to live. The dweller on the threshold is illusion, glamour, Maya, as realized by the physical brain and recognized as that which must be overcome. It is the bewildering thought form with which the disciple is confronted when he seeks to pierce through the accumulated glamour of the ages and find his true home in the place of light. The above are necessarily only generalizations and the result also of the activity of the analytical mind, but they serve to embody a part of the problem in words and to convey to your minds a definite thought form of what we shall later discuss in detail. As to the causes of this world condition, what can I say, brother of mine, which will convey meaning to your minds? The cause lies far back in the consciousness of the imperfect gods. Does that sentence really mean aught to you? But little, I fear. We must descend into the realm of greater practicality and only deal with the matter as far as it concerns humanity. Planetary illusion will later be briefly dealt with, But the immediate problem before man and the significant contribution of the disciple is the dissipation of much of the glamour in which mankind is immersed, and which, during the coming Aquarian age, will largely disappear in connection with the astral life of the race. The point I would here make is to call attention to the fact that it is in meditation and in the technique of mind control that the thinkers of the world will begin to rid the world of illusion. Hence the increasing interest in meditation as the weight of the world glamour is increasingly realized, and hence the vital necessity for right understanding of the way of mind control. Another point which should be noted is that in the crystallization of this material age comes the great opportunity to strike a deadly blow on the planetary dweller on the threshold. The reaction at this time, through the stress of circumstances, is bringing about a more spiritual understanding and a reorganization of human values, and this is part of the process whereby a vital part of the world glamour may be dissipated, if only all men of goodwill within the world aura adhere to their appointed task. When the Buddha was on earth and achieved illumination, he let in a flood of light upon the world problem through his enunciation of the Four Noble Truths. His body of disciples and his 900 arhats formulated those four great truths into a structure of dogma and doctrine that, by the power of collective thought, has greatly helped in the attack upon the world illusion. Today the Christ is carrying forward the same great task, and in the spiritual significance of his imminent coming, and in the language of symbolism, he and his 9,000 arhats will strike a second blow at the world glamour. It is for this that we prepare. Only the intuition can dispel illusion, and hence the need of training intuitives. Hence the service you can render to this general cause by offering yourselves for this training. If you can overcome glamour in your own lives, and if you can therefore comprehend the nature of illusion, you will help in A. the destruction of the dweller on the threshold, B. the devitalizing of the general Maya, C. the dissipation of glamour, D. the dispelling of illusion. This you have to do in your own lives and in the group relation. Then your more general contribution will help in the wider human issues. The acuteness of the intellect and the illumination of the mind, plus love and intention, will accomplish much. To this service, I reiterate my call. During the next few months, I would suggest that you do three things. 1. Define in your own words and as the result of meditation your understanding of the four expressions with which I have been dealing. I ask for a real analysis and not just four sentences of definition. Before I enlarge upon this subject, I would like you to organize your minds on the matter, using definitions as a guide to your thought, yet stating the problem as you see it, and seeking to see the differences existing between these four aspects of the world glamour. 2. Say each day with care and thought a very familiar prayer, the Lord's Prayer. It has many meanings, and the trite and usual Christian significance is not for you. Ponder on this most ancient formula of truth, and interpret it entirely in terms of a formula for the dissipation of illusion. Write an exegesis on it from this angle, taking it phrase by phrase, and regarding it as giving us 7 keys to the secret of the elimination of glamour. The formula, which is not essentially a prayer, can be divided as follows. A. Invocation to the Solar Lord. B. 7 sentences embodying 7 keys for the dissipation of illusion. C. A final affirmation of divinity. Use your intuition and apply these all to the subject of glamour, and see at what knowledge you will arrive. Then write it down in the form of an interpretation or article, and we may arrive at much value. 3. Keep a copy of your full moon record, and at the close of 6 months, subject it to a careful analysis and see what is the sum total of gain. Divide your analysis into the following heads and express your understanding of the phenomena. A. As to any real contact. B. As to any color contact or phenomena. C. As to any other phenomena sensed or seen or heard. That we may all go forward into greater light and understanding, and that the light may shine upon the vertical way of the disciple is my prayer and aspiration for you. Section 1. The Nature of Glamour. In the preceding pages, we dealt with certain definitions of the words frequently used interchangeably dealing with illusion and glamour. We found that 1. Illusion is primarily of a mental quality and was characteristic of the attitude of mind of those people who are more intellectual than emotional. They have outgrown glamour as usually understood. It is the misunderstanding of ideas and thought forms of which they are guilty, and of misinterpretations. 2. Glamour is astral in character, and is far more potent at this time than illusion, owing to the enormous majority of people who function astrally always. 3. Maya is vital in character, and is a quality of force. It is essentially the energy of the human being as it swings into activity through the subjective influence of the mental illusion or astral glamour, or of both in combination. 4. The dweller on the threshold, always present, swings, however, into activity only on the path of discipleship when the aspirant becomes occultly aware of himself, of the conditions induced within him as a result of his interior illusion, his astral glamour, and the Maya surrounding his entire life. Being now an integrated personality, and no one is a disciple, my brother, unless he is mental as well as emotional, which is a point the devotee oft forgets, these three conditions, with the preponderance of the effect in one or other of the bodies, are seen as a whole, and to this whole the term the dweller on the threshold is applied. It is in reality a vitalized thought form, embodying mental force, astral force, and vital energy. The problem, therefore, before all of you in this group is to learn, first of all, 1. To distinguish between these three inner illusory aspects. 2. To discover what conditions in the environment or in the individual constitution induce these situations of difficulty. 3. To find out what methods are effective in inducing a cessation of the bewildering, deceiving conditions. It must be remembered also that these distorting conditions found in all of you are the medium whereby you are tuned in on the world glamour and illusion. The emphasis has been laid in esoteric teaching on the training and liberation of the individual aspirant. This is, of course, necessary, for the mass is made up of the individuals, and in the steady release from the control of these inner delusions will come the eventual clarification of humanity. Therefore, each of you in this group must of necessity work separately and apart with himself, and learn to induce those conditions of clarity and truth which will overcome the ancient rhythms and deep-seated habits, and thus steadily purify the aura. But this has now to be done as a group, and this group constitutes one of the first of the exoteric groups with which it is intended to work in the new age. Through the activity of such groups, the world glamour will be dissipated, but first of all the aspirant must learn to deal with individual and group glamour. It is necessary to remember the following three things. I am going to be brief and technical in teaching this group, for my time is short, and you have an adequate technical knowledge with which to understand that whereof I speak. First, the united auras of the group members ever determine the group condition, the group activity, usefulness, problem, and glamour. Hence emerges individual group responsibility and individual usefulness. Each of you either hinders or aids the group according to his auric condition, which is either in a state of glamour or illusion, or is kept relatively free from these conditions. Second, that the first job that each of you has to do is to determine his own peculiar problem. In giving you your individual instructions, I will take up with you in this instruction where the particular tendency in this direction of each of you lies, and whether it is glamour, illusion, or Maya to which you habitually succumb. I will deal with directness, for I have tested your sincerity and believe in your willingness to be told the truth. Once you have each determined the specific nature of your peculiar problem, you can then work with deliberation towards its solution. With deliberation, brother of old, and with no speed, but with due care and caution, and with right understanding. Thirdly, you must remember that as I look at the individual in any of these groups, I can at the same time gauge the quality of the group itself as a whole. The amount of inner light that can shine through and make its presence felt in your auras can be seen by me and indicate to me the strength and the efficiency and also the potency of your individual group influence, for the positive auras subordinate the negative auras. What is required is a combination of positive auras deliberately subordinated to group work. As you deal with illusion and as you free your minds from its effects, and as you dissipate the astral glamour in which you are all more or less immersed, you will enter into a greater freedom of living and usefulness. As the Maya of distorted energy currents ceases to swing you into lines of undesirable activity, the light that is in you will shine forth with greater clarity. Incidentally, the dweller on the threshold will slowly and surely disintegrate and leave your way to the door of initiation, free and unimpeded. Strongly mental types are subject to illusion. This illusion is, in reality, a condition wherein the aspirant is being definitely controlled by 1. A thought form of such potency that it does two things. A. Controls the life activity or output. B. Tunes the aspirant in on the mass thought forms which are of a similar nature and which are built by others under the dominance of a similar illusion. This, in its worst aspect, produces mental insanity or idée fixe, but in its least dangerous and normal result, produces the fanatic. The fanatic is usually, even if he realizes it not, a bewildered man who has a potent idea of some kind or another, but who finds it quite impossible to integrate it into the world picture, to make those needed, and often divinely directed, compromises which profoundly help humanity, to find the time or place for the realities which are within his natural grasp. 2. When a man is highly developed, the mental illusion is built around a definite intuition, and this intuition is concretized by the mind until its appearance is so real that the man believes he sees so clearly that which should be done or given to the world that he spends his time endeavoring in a fanatical manner to make others see it too. Thus his life slips away on the wings of illusion, and his incarnation is a relatively profitless one. In a few rare cases, this combination of intuition and mental activity produces the genius in some field or another, but then there is no illusion, but clear thinking coupled with a trained equipment in that particular field or enterprise. 3. The weaker and more average mental types of people succumb to the general field of illusion and of mass illusion. The mental plane manifests a different sort of distortion to that of the astral plane or the etheric. The faculty of discrimination which is being developed has produced sharper lines of demarcation, and instead of the dense fogs and mists of the astral plane or the swirling tides and currents of energy of the etheric plane, we have on the mental plane masses of sharply indicated thought forms of a particular quality and note and tone, around which are grouped lesser thought forms created by those who respond to these forms and to their note, quality, and tone. Similarities are then seen to exist which constitute channels or avenues for the magnetic drawing power of the more potent thought forms. Ancient theologies in modern garb fix presentations of half-truth, the wild thinking of various world groups, and many similar emanating sources have, down the ages, produced the world of illusion and those mental states which have held humanity prisoner to wrong concepts and thoughts. So many are these thought-producing illusions that the effect in the world today has been to cause a general division of the human race into varying schools of thought, philosophy, science, religion, sociology, etc., etc., into many parties and groups, all of them colored by an analogous idea, into groups of idealists fighting each other on behalf of their pet concepts, and into tens of thousands of participants in group mental activity. These are today producing the world literature through which the world platforms are colored. By their means, the world leaders are inspired, and they are responsible at this time for the mass of experiments in the field of government, of education, and of religion, which are producing so much of the world unrest, and consequently so much of the world illusion. What is needed, therefore, at this time, are thinkers who are training themselves in that mental attitude and one-pointedness which is divorced from the danger of a negative receptivity and is responsive, at the same time, to the higher intuitional inspiration. It is mediating interpreters of ideas that are needed and not mediums. The emotional types respond with facility to world glamour and to their own individual, inherited, and self-induced glamour. The bulk of the people are purely emotional, with occasional flashes of real mental understanding. Very occasional, my brother, and usually entirely absent. Glamour has been likened to a mist or fog in which the aspirant wanders and which distorts all that he sees and contacts, preventing him from ever seeing life truly or clearly, or the conditions surrounding him as they essentially are. When he is a somewhat advanced aspirant, he is aware of the glamour, and occasionally sees in a flash in what direction truth for him may lie. But then again the glamour settles down upon him, and he is rendered powerless to release himself or to do anything constructive. His problem becomes further complicated by his consequent distress and his deep disgust with himself. He walks ever in a fog and sees naught as it truly exists. He is deceived by the appearance and forgets that which the appearance veils. The emanatory astral reactions which each human being initiates ever surround him, and through this mist and fog he looks out upon a distorted world. These reactions and the surrounding aura which they constitute blend and merge with the world glamour and fog, and form part of the miasmas and unhealthy emanations for which the masses of men for millions of years are responsible. I would point out to you that in Lemurian days, glamour and illusion were relatively unknown from the human standpoint. There were no mental reactions and but little emotional response to environment. Men were largely instinctual animals. Glamour began to be found in Atlantean days, and since that time has steadily precipitated, until today, when the hierarchy looks at humanity, it appears to be walking in a deep and constantly changing density of currents which hide and distort, and which swirl around the sons of men and prevent their seeing the light as it is. This is all the more obvious when it is remembered that the other kingdoms of nature are relatively free from glamour and illusion. In our race, the Aryan, the world illusion is gathering weight and slowly emerging into recognition in the human consciousness, and this is a real point gained, for that which is recognized can then be intelligently handled if the will to do so exists. Today, illusion is so potent that few people whose minds are in any way developed but are controlled by these vast illusory thought forms which have their roots and draw their life from the lower personality life and desire nature of the masses of men. It is interesting to remember also, in connection with our Aryan race, that these thought forms draw their vitality also from the realm of ideas, but of ideas wrongly intuited and grasped and forced to serve the selfish purposes of men. Their forms have been brought into activity by the steadily growing creative power of mankind, and have been subordinated to the wishes of men through the use of language with its power to limit and distort. The illusion is also precipitated more potently than would otherwise be the case by the effort of many devoted idealistic men to impose these distorted thought forms upon the mental bodies of the masses. This constitutes one of the major problems with which the hierarchy today has to concern itself. It is also one of the first factors which a master has to consider in connection with any aspirant and disciple. Glamour, as we have seen, is of more ancient standing and of earlier emergence than is illusion. It has little in it of the mental quality and is the major factor controlling the majority. The objective of all training given on the path of discipleship and up to the third initiation is to induce that clear thinking which will render the disciple free from illusion and give to him that emotional stability and poise which gives no room for the entrance of any of the world glamour. This freedom becomes possible when there is in the aspirant no personal glamour and no deliberately self-induced response to the determining factors which have produced glamour down the ages. With these factors we will later deal. Maya is the result of both glamour and illusion. It connotes, when present, an integrated personality and therefore the capacity to tune in on mental illusion and astral glamour. Where this condition is found, the problem of the disciple is one of the greatest in the world. What constitutes the prime difficulty of any disciple is the fact that the battleground of his life involves every aspect of his nature. The whole man is involved. Technically, the word Maya should only be used in two cases. One, in reference to the united glamour illusion to which a man who is an integrated personality responds. Two, in speaking of the limitations of the planetary logos of our planet. In the above remarks, I have given you much food for thought, not only as regards your own personal problems, for all of you are subject to these conditions, but I have also indicated to you what is the nature of glamour. The word is used in all esoteric books and teaching to cover the conditions which are differentiated under the words Maya, illusion, and glamour itself. Later I will give you some teaching upon the causes of glamour and the methods of its dissipation. But I have given you here enough for the present, for it is my desire that you ponder upon these ideas during the next few months and learn somewhat of the significance of these words which you so lightly use. Watch yourselves and your daily life with discrimination, so that you learn to distinguish between glamour, illusion, and Maya. See whether you can discover the form which your individual dweller upon the threshold is likely to assume as you come into conflict with it, and if you do the same for your group brothers and the immediate world need, you will lose no time in the work of your astral clarification and mental release. I would ask you to study these instructions with peculiar care, for I am taking the time and trouble these busy days to meet your need and to bring as much light as I can, without infringing your free will, to meet your need and clear your course to service. I would suggest also that you find out all that you can anent the much misunderstood subject of the aura. Search out what is said in my books and in the writings extant in any good occult library. I seek no copying out of paragraphs, but a formulation of your knowledge so that you can answer clearly questions which might be asked. The following three questions are basic. 1. What is the aura, and how does it come into existence? 2. How can the aura be made the medium of light, and the light which should shine through it be intensified? 3. Have you noticed what is the effect which your own individual aura is making upon your environment, and how can you improve that effect? This will enable you to make practical application of that which I seek to teach you. Forget not that as you look out upon the world and your immediate environment, that you look out through your aura, and have therefore to deal with glamour and illusion. There are three further questions which you might put to yourself, facing the issue in the light of your soul. 1. Do I suffer primarily from glamour or from illusion? 2. Do I know which quality or characteristic in my nature facilitates my tuning in on the world glamour or the world illusion? 3. Have I reached the point where I can recognize my peculiar dweller on the threshold, and can I state what form it takes? That you may indeed as individuals and also as a group learn the meaning of true self-knowledge and so learn to stand in spiritual being, increasingly free from glamour and illusion, is the prayer of your friend and brother who has fought his way through to a greater measure of light. During the past 6 months, 4 members of this group of students have been fighting glamour in their own individual lives and for the most part successfully. I make reference to this because in an experimental group such as this, it is well to anticipate such a situation. Such wrestling will naturally occur because only that which is experimentally known becomes a true content of the equipment of the disciple. Earlier, I referred to the fact that part of the plan of the hierarchy embraces the starting of small groups such as this one, which would have the definite objective of providing the active means whereby the world glamour, today so potent and deep, can be dissipated. The time has not yet come for dealing with the world illusion on a large scale, for the race is not adequately mental, nor has the illusion, which is, as I have stated, preeminently the result of the misinterpretation of ideas, reached its height. But the hour has struck for the first steps to be taken in the dissipation of glamour, and the hold of glamour upon the race should be appreciably lessened in the future. Hence the practical training now being given in this group in their own lives. Hence also the intended teaching later to be given to the group, if they measure up to the opportunity, which will enable them to aid in the concerted and planned attack upon the world glamour. Wrestle, therefore, with your personal problems along these lines, my brothers, for in this way you will gain facility in discernment, in clear, precise action, and in strengthened understanding. In the process of dissipating glamour, the way of the greatest potency is to realize the necessity to act purely as a channel for the energy of the soul. If the disciple can make right alignment and consequent contact with his soul, the results show as increased light. This light pours down and irradiates not only the mind, but the brain consciousness as well. He sees the situation more clearly. He realizes the facts of the case as against his vain imaginings, and so the light shines upon his way. He is not yet able to see truly in the larger sweeps of consciousness. The group glamour and, of course, the world glamour remain to him as yet a binding and bewildering mystery, but his own immediate way begins to clear, and he stands relatively free from the fog of his ancient and distorting emotional miasmas. Alignment, contact with his soul, and then steadfastness are the keynotes to success. It will therefore be apparent to you that small groups such as this, if established in different countries and cities, and if successful in their personal activities, could play a most useful part. Such groups would have two aspects to their endeavor. They would have to wrestle with group glamour, which creeps inevitably into group life through the instrumentality of the group members. Their united personal glamours provide the open door through which group glamour can enter. An instance of this can be seen in this group when glamour entered in through the medium of LTSK and swept IBS into its vortex of force. It was overcome, fortunately, leaving you all the richer and more united on account of the strong stand in love taken by the other group members. May I remind LTSK and IBS of their deep indebtedness to the love of their brothers. The group love protected them. IBS has gone a long way in freeing herself from certain aspects of glamour. LTSK is also freer than he was, but still has much to do. It is always difficult for the third ray person to cultivate the intuition. The apparently profound wisdom of the manipulative and devious science of the intelligence inherent in matter prevents oft the entrance of the true wisdom of the illumined mind. 6 months ago, I felt that it was probably impossible for LTSK to free himself from the glamour in which he habitually walked. Today, a little more light shines upon his way, and he may, if he frees himself still further from his self-generated thought forms, make the needed grade. When group glamour has been somewhat dissipated, and the group can walk in the lighted way with freedom, then will come the time when the group can be trained in group alignment, group contact, and group steadfastness. It can then begin the definite and scientific task of attacking the world glamour. It is of interest in this particular group to be reminded that this is part of the activity now being undertaken by certain people in the new group of world service. Through the emphasis in the world of certain basic ideas such as goodwill and mutual interdependence, much is being done to dissipate the glamour in which the people of the world are walking. It is not the function of every server to form part of the massed attack upon the world glamour which is now getting underway. Everyone has to deal with glamour in his own personal life, but functions and activities differ. Yours is the work of the trained observers, and that training takes much time. At present, many of you do not recognize glamour when it meets you and envelops you. It is only by its effects that you eventually know it for what it is. The time must come when your processes of observation are so keen that you will recognize it in its true nature before it immerses and engulfs you and produces those conditions which enable you to say later, "Why did I allow myself to be glamoured? Why was I so deluded?" At this point, I desire to do two things. I seek to outline a little more carefully this discussion or short treatise on glamour so that our ideas may be clearly formulated and you will have a textbook for future reference which will serve to guide your group and analogous groups in the way of right activity. Secondly, I wish to recapitulate somewhat those things which I have already stated so as to enrich your understanding of the various phases of the world glamour. This world glamour, the analytical mind, has to differentiate into distinctive phases, calling them illusion, glamour, maya, and that synthetic thought form found on the path of discipleship, which is called by some schools of esotericism the dweller on the threshold. As you will see from this, my brothers, we have set ourselves a large theme, which must be very carefully handled. My task is a difficult one because I write for those who are still held by the varying aspects of glamour and usually by the secondary glamour and maya. Illusion does not yet fully play its part and the dweller is seldom adequately realized. I would here remind you of a stupendous occult fact and will ask you to endeavor to understand that whereof I speak. The dweller on the threshold does not emerge out of the fog of illusion and of glamour until the disciple is nearing the gates of life. Only when he can catch dim glimpses of the portal of initiation and an occasional flash of light from the angel of the presence, who stands waiting beside that door, can he come to grips with the principle of duality, which is embodied for him in the dweller and the angel. Do you comprehend that whereof I speak? As yet, my words embody for you symbolically a future condition and event. The day will surely come, however, when you will stand in full awareness between these symbols of the pairs of opposites, with the angel on the right and the dweller on the left. May strength then be given to you to drive straight forward between these two opponents who have for long ages waged warfare in the field of your life, and so may you enter into that presence where the two are seen as one, and naught is known but life and deity. In summarizing some of the information I have given to you concerning the four aspects of glamour, I would offer the following tabulation for your careful consideration. The following tabulation is entitled The Aspects of Glamour. It has six columns, the first column entitled Name, the second Plane, the third column Opposite, the fourth column Objective, the fifth column Battleground, the sixth column entitled Technique. Name, illusion, plane, mental, opposite, intuition, spiritual perception, objective, dispelling, battleground, path of initiation, world of ideas, technique, contemplation by soul. Name, glamour, plane, astral, opposite, illumination, lucidity, vision, objective, dissipation, battleground, path of discipleship, technique, meditation, holding mind steady in the light. Name, maya, plane, etheric, opposite, inspiration, objective, devitalization, battleground, path of probation, purification, technique, occultism, force manipulation. Name, dweller on the threshold, plane, physical brain consciousness, opposite, angel of the presence, objective, discrimination, battleground, integrated personality, technique, at-one-ment, end of duality. End of tabulation.
End of side 2, cassette number 1, Glamour, a World Problem, page 40. Continued on cassette number 2.